This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley of TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. Like many mothers, our guest Ayelet Waldman has suffered from what she calls bad mother anxiety. That's why her memoir, now out in paperback, is called Bad Mother, a chronicle of maternal crimes, minor calamities, and occasional moments of grace. Waldman is the mother of four and is best known as the author of the Mommy Track novels, a series about a public defender turned stay-at-home mom who grows frustrated at home and ends up becoming a part-time detective. Her next novel, Red Hook Road, is scheduled for publication next month. Waldman didn't become a writer until after becoming a mother. Like the character in her series, she was a public defender and really liked the work. When she was pregnant with her first child, she worked until the last minute. And when she returned to her job, her husband, the well-known writer Michael Chabon, stayed home with the baby. There were times Waldman was at the office with her breast pump whirring while she was on the speakerphone with a client. Then she'd get a call from her husband about how he and their daughter Sophie went to the pool, and story time at the library, and how he saw her take her first steps. And Waldman started to feel like she was really missing out. One day, she packed up her office to become a stay-at-home mom. Terry spoke with Ayelet Waldman last year and asked if staying home and taking her daughter to the pool in the library was as wonderful as she thought it would be.
Well, absolutely. It was lovely. It was, you know, the baby pool and mommy and me and story time at the library. And that whole first day that I was back, it was awesome. And then the second day, it was story time at the library and the baby pool and mommy and me. And then the third day and the fourth day and the fifth day. And really, within a week, I had started to completely lose my mind. But I am incredibly stubborn, and I had good reasons for going back, so I decided that I was going to stick with it, and I was going to stay home, and I was going to do this thing, and I wasn't going to give up and go back to work.
Now, you write in your memoir that once you made that decision to stay home, and then you realized you were losing your mind, that you went on a rant that we daughters of feminists had essentially been lied to. What was the lie?
Well, I was raised by a 1970s feminist. My mom had a consciousness raising group. I used to sit at the top of the stairs and listen to them. I mean, they went, you know, they did the whole thing. I'm not sure if they ever actually got the speculum out, but I wouldn't be surprised if they did. And my mom and her friends had these incredibly frustrated professional lives. And what they raised us to do, what she raised me to do, is to live out the kind of professional experience in life that she had never managed to have. And they never said how hard it was going to be. You know, my mother never made it clear that this was going to pull me in as many directions as it was, because I don't think she even thought so. I mean, she thought that if I had the kind of professional life that she had always longed for, then everything else would fall into place. So I'm 44 years old, and I think I'm part of the first generation of women raised by these feminist mothers. And when I first was feeling so frustrated and depressed and angry about being stuck at home, I really kind of turned on that message. And I said, you know, this was a lie. This whole thing was a lie. We can't have it all. And at first I was angry, but I think what ended up happening is that it's not so much that I've mellowed, but that I've developed some perspective.
How would you compare your idea of what it means to be a feminist with your mother's?
Well, you know, at a very basic level, we have the same idea of what it means to be a feminist. I mean, I absolutely call myself a feminist. And by that, I mean a woman who believes that your opportunities should not be constrained by your gender, that women should be entitled to the same opportunities as men. And my mother feels that way, too. I think the difference is, in between women of my generation and my mother's generation, and between my mother and me, is a kind of gradations and shades of gray. And, you know, in one area that is really obvious, it's in abortion. So for women of my mother's generation who struggled so hard to get the right to abortion, what they needed to do in order to achieve that right and to maintain it was to describe what they were doing in a certain way. So I you know, when they were describing the process of having an abortion, language was really important to them. So they never called the baby a baby. It was a fetus. It was an embryo at best, you know. It was, and this is a quote, a clump of cells. But to women like me who've grown up in the age of the ultrasound, we now have three-dimensional ultrasounds of our babies from the very beginning, you know, when we can actually see their features, recognizable features, and we can see them suck their thumbs. And for us, abortion, even though I think I am absolutely as committed to choice as my mother is, the idea of abortion and the fact of abortion has become something very different. And I think women of my mother's generation are very uncomfortable with how we talk about abortion.
If you don't mind, I'd like to talk with you about a very difficult decision you had to make. When you were about 35, you were carrying your third child, and because of your age and the risks associated with pregnancy at that age, you decided to have amniocentesis. And tell us what you found.
I had just turned 35, so it was sort of up in the air whether I would have an amnio at all. But I am by nature very pessimistic, so I decided that I had to have one. And the ultrasound at the amnio was very, very normal. We saw the baby. I remember they gave us a photograph of his feet, just sort of like almost like footprints. And then we came home, and about 10 days later, we were leaving for a family vacation in Hawaii. And I decided I was just going to call my obstetrician to find out, you know, get the kind of clear, go ahead, the bill of clean bill of health, just so that I wouldn't have any worries when we were, you know, floating in the ocean. And I called her, and this experience is so clear in my mind in such a strange way. I called her, and she said, "Are you sitting down?" And at that moment, I kind of felt myself lift out of my body, and I almost felt like I was watching what was happening in this very detached way, almost hot, like hovering up on the ceiling. I remember having this thought, oh, wow, when something terrible happens, people really do fall on the ground and scream. And I had fallen on the ground, and I was holding the phone and just wailing. And my husband, Michael, took the phone out of my hand and talked to the doctor. And then we embarked on this, that was a Friday, and we embarked on these 3 days of just misery. We went to the genetic counselor, and we found out that the baby had a genetic abnormality that's rare. It's a trisomy, a triple chromosome, but not trisomy 21, which is Down syndrome, which is the most common trisomy, but a different one. And a much more ambiguous defect. On the one hand, there was a decent chance that the baby would have this genetic defect but would be unaffected, that you would never know that he would lead, and it was a boy, that he would lead a very normal life that you wouldn't be able to tell. And there, on the other hand, there were chances that he would be mentally retarded or be predisposed to cancers of the kidney, things like that.
So, you know, when you have amniocentesis, you usually have it with the idea that if it came back with bad news, you'd have an abortion. Otherwise, why bother to go through with the amnio in a way? Maybe that's faulty logic.
Absolutely. No, I think that's definitely true.
But when you were slapped in the face by this really bad news, was the decision obvious to you about what to do?
You know, in one way, the decision was really, really obvious to me. I mean, I knew as soon as I heard the news what I wanted to do, what I was going to do. But the decision was, you know, there's your decision and then your decision as a couple, as a family. And my husband is as much of an optimist as I am a pessimist. And he heard the statistics and he thought, all right, we're good. We're safe. And so we spent 3 days kind of trying to come together. And as a couple, we weren't arguing at all. It was almost the most intimate experience of our marriage. But at the end, I remember we were sitting at the kitchen table and crying. We'd been crying pretty much for 3 days. And he said, you know, if you're wrong and there's nothing wrong with the baby and we have this abortion, I will always love you and our relationship will continue unaffected. But if I'm wrong and we have this baby and he is in fact mentally retarded, I don't know if we make it. And it was this, you know, moment of terrible honesty, and we both just cried. And then the next day we went and we had these abortions take a number of days, and we had the sort of the first step of that 2-day abortion.
Can I stop you when your husband said if I'm wrong and the baby's born mentally retarded, I don't know if we make it, what did that mean?
I think he meant two things. I think he meant that our family would be forever changed. But I think he also meant, and I know he meant this, and I think he meant that he didn't know if I would be able to forgive him. And, you know, in a way that was a very harsh thing to say, but he was right. I mean, he knows me more than anybody, better than anybody else in the world knows me. And at that moment, he was saying, you know, I know you and I love you. And I, you know, I want to make sure that this doesn't happen. And it took, you know, I had to look in the mirror at that moment and look at the ugliest side of myself, too, and say, you know, you're right. It's not like I wouldn't love him, but I don't know if I would have forgiven him.
So you decided to have an abortion. You were 4 months pregnant. This is past the first trimester. What were your options?
Well, we had a D&E, which is a dilation and extraction, which is the, you know, and here's another point where, you know, my mother and I differ completely on this. You know, my mother, when she describes a procedure, she doesn't describe the details. And for me, I needed to know exactly what was happening. And in this procedure, your cervix is dilated and the baby is extracted, and the baby is extracted essentially in pieces from your uterus. It's horrible. It's the photographs that you see that the Right to Lifers show, you know, they're real photographs. I mean, that's really what it's like. And I say this because I feel like I can't support a woman's right to choose unless I'm willing to look at the darkest side of it. And that was the darkest side of it. So one of the things I asked the incredibly generous, gentle doctor who did the abortion was, I asked him if he would make sure that the baby didn't feel anything.
It's okay.
That was really important to me, that he be dead, essentially, before that grim process took place. And the doctor promised me that he would give an injection that would make that happen.
So what were your feelings when the abortion was over? Did you feel different about it than you did going into it? Did you have doubts that you didn't have before? Did you were you okay with yourself?
No, not for a while. I mean, almost immediately I decided that I had been completely wrong. Michael was right. The baby was fine. I had done this horrible, horrible thing. I had killed a baby because I was a coward. And I sank into what was really a 5-month-long depression. I have bipolar disorder, so I tend to cycle, but I have a very mild case, and I had never been really what I think of as clinically depressed until that moment. And I was just profoundly depressed. I was furious with myself. I just felt like the worst mother in the world. And it was only when I got pregnant again that depression lifted. And it lifted almost magically. I mean, as soon as I found that it was 5 months later that I got pregnant again. And as soon as I found that I was pregnant, the anxiety and the fear for that baby, for the baby with whom I was pregnant, did not dissipate. Not until I held her in my arms 9 months later, but the sort of self-loathing and the just trauma of it just kind of floated away.
You were talking before about the difference between how you see abortion and how your mother sees it, and how you think for your mother and her generation it was this black and white thing, that in order to fight for the right to have an abortion, you had to call what you were carrying a fetus and not a baby. You had to not acknowledge some of the darker sides of abortion, because if there was any gray area, you'd lose. You'd lose the fight. But you see gray area. You had the abortion anyways, but you see the pain, you see the gray area. Do you think if you had an abortion when you were in college, before you were married, before you became a mother, that abortion would have seemed different to you?
I've never said this ever, I don't think. I had an abortion before. No, I have never told that to anybody, you know, outside of my girlfriends. I had an abortion when I was much younger, and it was a first trimester abortion, and I did it without a moment's hesitation, without a moment's anxiety. I knew with utter certainty it was the right thing to do, and I can safely say it had no emotional effect on me. I was also about 4 weeks and 3 days pregnant. I mean, really, I had had the test the day that I missed my period, and I had the abortion 3 days later. So it was very different, you know, with this, what happened with, we call that the baby that we aborted, Rocket Ship. That was the name that my son had given for the when I was pregnant. With Rocket Ship, I felt him moving. I saw him on the ultrasound. But this really was, like my mom and her friend said, this really was a clump of cells. And it had no emotional resonance in my life afterwards at all.
And doesn't now?
You know, no, it really doesn't. I mean, I am so certain that it was the right decision. And it was so early. I mean, I do actually think there is a qualitative difference between aborting in the early part of the first trimester and in the middle or later part of the second trimester in a way that you feel about it and that you grow attached. I think there's a real difference. And I think that my reaction is probably pretty common. But I also know that there are people who have very early abortions who then go on to feel, a certain amount of trauma from that too. So I wouldn't want to, denigrate that experience either.
Do you mind if I ask how you and your mother discussed the abortion and if you used different language and if you had different, emotional ideas about it?
My mother is so devoted. She's just the warmest, most lovely woman. And she ached for me. I mean, she just ached for me. She wanted me to feel better. She just couldn't stand how much pain I was in. And one of the ways she tried to help me was to say, this wasn't real. It wasn't a baby. And I don't think she understood how much I needed not to talk about it like that. I don't think it didn't make sense to her how she thought I was just being unnecessarily self-flagellating when I would talk about him and what he looked like. And when I held those, I kept those ultrasound pictures. I have them still. There was this great divide in how she felt like I was making my pain last longer by dwelling on this side of it. And I felt like it was irresponsible not to accept that part of it and to really acknowledge what I had done.
Well, I really appreciate how much pain this abortion caused and what it's like to, reveal the first one you had. I just want to thank you for, for sharing that part of your life with us. So let me tell our guests who I'm speaking with. My guest is Ayelet Waldman, and she is probably best known for a series of crime novels that she's written called the Mommy Track novels, where it's a mother turned detective. So it's about motherhood and amateur detective work at the same time. She's written other books as well, and her new book is a memoir. It's called Bad Mother, a chronicle of maternal crimes, minor calamities, and occasional moments of grace. There's another really difficult topic that I want to talk with you about, if you don't mind. And
sure.
This was, you mentioned that you're manic depressive, and it's a fairly mild case of it, but still, when you were diagnosed, you were put on medication, which was very helpful, and right after that, you found out you were pregnant.
And yeah, then, like weeks later.
Yeah.
Almost immediately.
And then you had to decide, should you stay on the medication, which would be good for you, or should you get off of it because it might be bad for the baby you were carrying? And this is something that women go through with coffee and wine, let alone,
right?
Let alone biochemical kind of drugs. So
yeah, and I had stopped the coffee and stopped the wine and wasn't eating tuna and was, carefully making sure I got sufficient omega-3s and doing, sleeping on the right side, doing all the things that you're supposed to do in that kind of crazy neurotic way that contemporary American motherhood has told us we have to treat pregnancy. And then I was taking this medication that I knew was crossing into my baby's bloodstream. My doctor, I went to my obstetrician, I talked to my psychiatrist, and they all agreed that it was safe. The problem was that after I had the baby, it turned out that there were these research studies that showed that, in fact, it wasn't as clear cut. I mean, their babies who are exposed to SSRIs in utero are born with SSRIs in their system, and they go through SSRI withdrawal. And Abraham had a whole series of problems when he was born, really, which none of which you could actually say was a result of SSRI withdrawal. He couldn't nurse. He couldn't. He wasn't gaining weight. And while the studies showed that was a side effect, he also had this kind of bubble palate, if it had been a little higher of a bubble, it would have been a cleft palate. So that was most likely the cause of his difficulties. But to have taken those medications and then to read those studies and then to know that my baby for another reason entirely, but still was suffering from those very symptoms, was very difficult. And I don't know if I would make the same decision. In fact, I don't think I would make the same decision again. I mean, if, you know, I'm not, it's not impossible that I'll get pregnant again, although, you know, God forbid, as my mother says. But I would not take medication when I was pregnant now. I would try to kind of go it alone, although it would be hard. It would definitely be hard.
So was this your third or your fourth?
That was my last baby, my fourth, Abraham. Who's six now.
Ah.
And it was fine. I just have to say he's totally
good.
Normal.
Good.
You know.
You know, you mentioned the mild, relatively mild case of bipolar syndrome that you have, which is, you know, contrasting highs and lows, you know, depressions and mm-hmm. and manias. And the manias are, of course, very productive, and the depressions not so much. You say something really funny in your book, that you can always spot the other bipolar person at the party. She's the one regaling the room with the hysterical tale of her husband's virulent herpes outbreak.
Yep.
And you say sometimes, like, when you get into the manic phase, like, you talk too much, you say too much, you reveal too much. Do you feel like you ever did that, like, on your blog or, you know, in a
always.
Novel or something?
I mean, welcome to the world of the memoir, right? Where would the memoir be without bipolar writers? I mean, that's what – that whole oversharing thing is really a very clear symptom of bipolar disorder. And I'm not saying that every – you know, I'm not accusing every memoirist of being bipolar. But I think in a way it's kind of a gift. I mean, if we didn't have people who were missing a very clear line-drawing impulse that normal people have, then we wouldn't have these articles and essays and memoirs that we all look to identify with. I mean, I get most of the mail that I get is from people who say, thank you for saying that. I never would have said it myself, but it's so nice to read it. And, you know, lucky them, I'm crazy.
Give us an example of something you said that got that kind of comment.
Well, I mean, the whole thing about the abortion that we talked about, you know, that maybe that kind of oversharing was part of writing about that. But probably, I mean, certainly most infamously was when I wrote an essay in which I said that I loved my husband more than my children. That was definitely the most oversharing moment, particularly since it was an essay about sex and about sexless marriages. And I talked about my very not sexless marriage in far more detail than one should probably, certainly than my husband ever would have, let's just say.
Yeah, and the premise of the article was, you know, you knew so many mothers who weren't having sex any longer with their husbands, and you were trying to figure out why. And
right. The only reason I wrote that article was because I was writing it for an anthology and about, you know, all these different mothers writing about different things, this anthology called Because I Said So. And the editors came to me and they said, okay, we've got moms writing about cancer and about divorce and blah, blah, blah. And we don't have anybody writing about sex. And since you're the only person who's having any, it's got to be you.
Yeah, so you were trying to figure out, why is it that, like, so many mothers don't want or even have sex anymore, but you and your husband were enjoying a sexual life? Like, what was the difference? And your answer was...
My answer was that all of these women were good mothers. They had made this kind of erotic transference when they had children. They shifted all of their ardor and their passion and their devotion from their husbands to their children. The children had become the center of their passionate universes. And I'd never done that. I mean, I loved my kids like crazy. I love them still, even though some of them are turning into teenagers. But I had never sort of shifted that passionate focus. And I still loved my husband as much as I had, with the same kind of crazy devotion. And that if a good mother was a mother who loved her children more than anybody else in the world, then I was a bad mother because, and here was the line, I loved my husband more than my children. Ba-dum-bum.
And then you said, and I might as well quote it here, if I were to lose one of my children, God forbid, even if I lost all my children, God forbid, I would still have him, my husband. But my imagination simply fails when I try to picture a future beyond my husband's death.
Yeah, that was the killer. You know, what was going on is I had just finished this novel called Love and Other Impossible Pursuits, which was about a woman whose baby dies of SIDS. I just finished that novel, and I had spent a year in the head of this woman trying to get over the death of a child. So I felt like I had the capacity to imagine that. But I couldn't imagine writing a novel about a widow, and I still can't imagine writing that. I don't know, you know, the extent of that. That experience just seems utterly incomprehensible to me. So that's really why I said that. But, you know, of course, when one reads that, the kind of logical interpretation is that, you know, I'd throw my kids in front of a bus to save my husband. And that's just obviously not true. I would throw myself in front of the bus and then they'd go on to lead very happy lives without me.
You know what I thought of when I read this is that, you know, sometimes, well, I used to think to myself when my parents were alive, who should die first? Like one of them's going to have to outlive the other. Who would be able to survive outliving the other better? Which mm-hmm. would I would be? Would, how would I? You know, who would I better survive?
Right.
You know, if one died and the other lived, like how would I, you know, manage it? And then once I got to that, but these horrible thoughts, games right. like that slip into your mind. But once I'd get to that point, I'd kind of stop because I thought like, wow, I just can't go on with that. I mean, it's just I can't work that one through. And then sometimes this like even like really stupid thing pops in my mind, like if you had to be blind or deaf, which would you choose?
Oh, right. I mean, that's like right. that's it's a like, constant. I've done that my whole life.
Yeah.
I think that's just called being Jewish.
Maybe. But then once I like put that premise on the table, I think like I'm not going to play that game. That's a really stupid game. You don't have the choice. You don't have to make the choice. You'll never have to make that choice. So why even put yourself through it? And I never go any further, but it's like you followed that one through, that worst case scenario, you had to make the choice thing. You put it on the table, you made a decision, and then you put it in print and
Oi. Well, I think, you know, first of all, we're talking about that Lana oversharing impulse, but also I think because, I mean, what I was responding to is what I saw was, you know, when in a way I was saying, look, I'm not the one who set up this hierarchy, but if we're playing the game of hierarchy, well, I think you're wrong. So that's sort of how I did it. You know, it's so funny because everyone's so afraid of like, what do my kids think? Poor children when they read that. So I got very nervous about what my kids would say. And I sort of sat down my older daughter and this long explanation told her what was in the essay. And this is what she did. She looked at me and she went, duh, and walked away.
Well, I yell at, I want to really thank you a lot for talking with us. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much, Terry. It's so exciting for me.
I yell at Waldman speaking to Terry Gross last year. Her memoir, Bad Mother, is now out in paperback. Her next novel, Red Hook Road, comes out next month. Former Beatle Paul McCartney doesn't need any more awards or accolades, but just got another one. The Gershwin Prize, awarded to him this week at a White House ceremony and concert, honoring his lifetime of songwriting. Many of McCartney's song lyrics are collected in a book called Blackbird Singing, which also includes samples of old and new poems. Here's the song that inspired that book title, Blackbird, performed here by its composer at an MTV Unplugged concert in 1991.
Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly. All your life you were only waiting for this moment to rise. Singing in the dead of night. Take these sunken eyes and learn to see all your life. You were only waiting for this moment to be free. Blackbird flying.
Terry spoke with Paul McCartney in 2001 when his book Blackbird Singing was published. She asked him about meeting John Lennon, his songwriting partner in the Beatles.
Do you remember what the band was playing the first time you heard John with the band The Quarrymen?
Yeah, they were. They had a repertoire of kind of folksy, sort of bluesy things mixed with early rock and roll. And John and the band were playing a thing called Come Go With Me, which was a record for a group called the Del Vikings. It was an early rock and roll record. But John obviously didn't have the record, and he probably heard it a few times on radio. And being so musical, he just picked it up. And so he was doing a version of it. But what impressed me was, even though he didn't know the words, he would make them up, and he'd steal words from sort of blues songs. So instead of the real words, which I don't know, but he was singing, come go with me down to the penitentiary, which was more off Big Bill Brunsey or somebody, you know. But I thought, you know, that's inventive, that's ingenious. So I warmed to him immediately hearing that.
And how were you invited to play with the band?
Well, they were doing two sets. There was one in the afternoon when I first of all saw them, which was outdoors. And then there was to be one in the evening. And meantime, they had all this time to fill. So they went into the village hall where the evening gig was to be. And they were sitting around. And with all this time on their hands, John, who was 1.5 years older than me, had got hold of some beer from somewhere and was having a little drink. And we were sitting around and just playing various songs. And even though I was left-handed, I'd kind of learned to turn the guitar upside down and just about play songs, because my friends wouldn't let me retune their guitars, obviously. Too inconvenient for them. So I'd had to learn this left-handed method. So I turned the guitar around, I think it was his guitar, and I played a song, an early Eddie Cochran song, which was called 20 Flight Rock. And I must have done it quite well, because a couple of days later I was cycling around Walton, which was the area where I met John, and one of the friends, a guy called Pete Shotton, cycled up to me and said, hey, we were talking about you, you know, we enjoyed that 20 Flight Rock, and would you like to be in the band, you know? So I said, well, I'll have to consider this. You know, this is a big move to me. I'd never been in a professional outfit before. I'd never actually even hardly sung on stage before. I think I'd just done it once at a holiday camp somewhere. And so I said, I'll get back to you on that one. And a couple of days later, I did, and said, yeah, you know what? It wouldn't be a bad idea.
You have a poem for John in there. It's called Song for John. It's actually a lyric for a song that you recorded in 1982. But I was wondering if you could read it for us.
Okay. This poem's called Here Today. It was originally a song I recorded for John Lennon. And if I said I really knew you well, what would your answer be if you were here today? Well, knowing you, you'd probably laugh and say that we were worlds apart if you were here today. But as for me, I still remember how it was before, and I'm holding back the tears no more. I love you. What about the time we met? Well, I suppose you could say that we were playing hard to get, didn't understand a thing, but we could always sing. What about the night we cried, because there wasn't any reason left to keep it all inside? Never understood a word. But you were always there with a smile. And if I say I really loved you and was glad you came along, then you were here today, for you were in my song, here today.
When did you write this?
I wrote that shortly after John died.
What was the night that we cried that you referred to in the poem?
I seem to remember we had some time off in Key West, Florida, and it was because there was a hurricane and we'd been diverted, I think, from Jacksonville. So we had to spend a night or two in Key West, which is where we ended up anyway. And at that age, with that much time on our hands, we didn't really know what to do with it except get drunk. And so that was what we did, and we stayed up all night talking, like it was going out of style. And at some point early in the morning, I think we must have touched on some points that were really emotional, and we ended up crying, which was very unusual for us because we'd members of a band and young guys, we didn't do that kind of thing. So I always remembered it as a sort of important emotional landmark.
Do you remember what you were talking about that led to that?
Probably our mothers dying, because John and I shared that experience. My mother died when I was about 14, and his died shortly after, about a year or so after, I think. So this was a great bond John and I always had. We both knew the pain of it, and we both knew that we had to put on a brave face because we were sort of teenage guys, and you didn't talk about that kind of thing where we came from.
Now, that's the kind of thing that John really acted out through his music. I mean, he had a couple of songs that were really about that and were were very emotional. It's not the kind of thing you really did, though. None of the songs, as far as I know, were really about your mother.
Well, no, mine's veiled. My style is more veiled. And also, at the time the songs were written that you're talking about, like Mother, John was going through primal scream therapy.
Exactly, right.
And, you know, that's going to get it out of you.
Right.
I didn't actually go through any of that. So my stuff tended to be more veiled, or I would tend to talk to friends, relatives, loved ones about it in private. Mine would emerge, I think, probably in songs like Yesterday. It's been put to me, although it's kind of subconscious, but it's been put to me that the song Yesterday was probably about my mother. Why she had to go, I don't know. She wouldn't say, I did something wrong, now I long for yesterday, lest yesterday all my troubles were so far away. I'm sure that was to do with my mother dying, but as I said, kind of age group we were then, it wasn't the done thing to talk about things like that. And it was much later, when John got into therapy in America, that he wrote some songs that directly dealt with it.
Now, your songs were co-credited, you know, in the Beatles era. My understanding is, and correct me if I'm wrong, that many of the songs were written by one of you or the other, although the other would do some editing on the song. But a few of the songs were actually true collaborations. Is that right? Is that accurate?
Yeah, well, what happened was, in the early days, they were pretty much, the very earliest days were separate. We wrote one or two separately before we actually got together. But when we got together and actually started writing the earliest Beatles stuff, everything was co-written. We hardly ever wrote things separate. But then, after a few years, and as we got a bit of success with the Beatles and didn't actually live together or weren't just always on the road together, sharing hotel rooms, then we had the luxury of writing stuff separately. So John would write something like Nowhere Man, sort of separately in his house in outside London. And I would write something like Yesterday, quite separately on my own. And as you say, we would come together and check them out against each other. Sometimes we would edit a line of each other's, but more often we'd just sort of say, yeah, that's great. And very often, a line that one of us was going to chuck out, we would encourage the other not to chuck out because it was a good line. I had a line in Hey Jude much later that said, the movement you need is on your shoulder. And I thought that was me just blocking out the line. And I said, I'll change that. He said, you won't, you know, that's the best line in it. And similarly, I would encourage him to keep lines in his songs that he didn't think were very good. And I'd say, no, that's a really great line. There was a song of his called Glass Onion, where he had a line about the walrus. Here's another clue for you all. The walrus was Paul. And he wanted to keep it, but he needed to check it with me. He said, what do you think about that line? I said, it's a great line. You know, it's a spoof on the way everyone was always reading into our songs. I said, here we go. You know, we give them another clue to follow. So we would check stuff against each other. It was obviously very handy for our writing to be able to do that.
Paul McCartney speaking with Terry Gross in 2001. This week, he was rewarded the Gershwin Prize for Songwriting at a White House concert honoring him that will be televised by PBS in July. The Canadian director Vincenzo Natali had a cult hit with his gory 1997 sci-fi thriller Cube. His new film, Splice, features Adrian Brody and Sarah Polley as scientists who create and attempt to manage a constantly transforming part-human life form. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
Creating new life, it's a messy business. So said Mary Shelley in the early 19th century in Frankenstein or The Modern Prometheus. You'd think, given all the gene mapping and cloning around, that horror movies would be lousy with Frankenstein scenarios, cautionary tales in which technology outpaces our understanding of how to use it. But mostly, we get splatter, torture porn, lame remakes. In that context, Vincenzo Natali's Splice beckons to us like a luminous laboratory beaker, an alluring new brew. It's set in Toronto and owes much to David Cronenberg, especially his films The Brood and The Fly. Throw in Splice and you have an Ontario subgenre, faceless, sterile modern settings, wintry and blue-lit, in which new kinds of flesh are grown or hatched. In Splice, Canada's own Sarah Polley and long-faced Adrian Brody play Clive and Elsa, celebrated nerdy researchers for a pharmaceutical company, called, in fact, NERD, for Nucleic Exchange Research Development. When we meet them, they're delivering a new life form from a pulsing ovum in an incubator, a giant wormy mass from which they hope to mine all kinds of patent-worthy medical processes. But then company bigwigs put the kibosh on future research. Use what's there and generate capital they command. That's when Clive and Elsa think, why not mix in human DNA and see what grows? After a lot of tinkering, the implant takes. The fetus, a kitchen sink of species, comes quickly to term. And then we hear the words immortalized by Colin Clive in the 1931 film of Frankenstein.
It's alive!
Get out of there, I'm gonna gas it.
Wait. Don't kill it.
Elsa, get out, okay? I'm hitting the gas.
I'm not gonna hurt you.
In 3, 2, 1.
Clive, I said don't!
Clive is about to gas the lab and kill the infant creature, but to stop him, Elsa has whipped off her oxygen helmet. That's the first sign the couple will approach this child from different angles. What's endlessly fascinating in Splice is trying to get a handle on what the creature is. Elsa calls it Dren, nerd spelled backwards, and it's seemingly female. Now it's a pile of flesh with eyes on either side of its head. Then, quickly, since its growth is accelerated, it looks humanoid, albeit with other components, from amphibious to avian, plus a long tail with a lethal spike. It has no language you'd recognize, clicks and rattles and chirps. When Dren makes too much of a racket, Clive and Elsa sneak her down, she's wearing a cute little dress, to the facility's dank basement.
Go open the door. You stop it. Shh. So I feel like a criminal.
Scientists push boundaries. It's the important ones too.
Yeah, sticking to a few rules isn't always such a bad idea either, you know?
Nobody is going to care about a few rules after they see what we have made.
See what we've made? Is that what you just said?
Yeah.
Nobody can see what we made.
Don't you think the world's going to want to know what's next? Do you think they could really look at this face and see anything less than a miracle?
You know no good will come from this, right? But the way in which it all goes bad has a distinctly human dimension. It turns out that Elsa, so militantly maternal, had an abusive mom. And as Dren grows over a couple of months and becomes more assertive, like a mischievous child and then a rebellious teenager, something dark and scary in Elsa takes hold. And Clive, who wanted to destroy Dren, begins to soften. Soon this high-tech Frankenstein acquires a vein of freaky, low-tech gothic psychodrama. Adrian Brody and Sarah Polley are thoroughly convincing when their characters are smart, and only slightly less so when they turn crazy dumb. The Paris-born actress Delphine Cheniac plays the maturing Dren with help from creature effects designer Howard Berger, and she has her own mythical beauty. Her head tilts, bird-like, as her wide almond eyes take in her new world. I'm sad to say the climax of Splice is too rushed. But if gene splicing can give us monsters as poetically strange as Dren, it bodes well for our horror movies, if not necessarily for our species.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. You can see several clips from Splice and download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. You can also join us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air.